Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
Together, we'll be mobilizing more than $1 billion for railway lines that extend from Angola to Zambia to the DRC and ultimately to the Indian Ocean.
A year after hosting the president of Angola at the White House, President Biden's in Angola today. The first sitting U.S. president to visit the African nation as the U.S. moves to counter China's growing power in the region. We'll get the latest. Then, as Biden faces bipartisan criticism for pardoning his son Hunter, we'll speak to the Last Prisoner Project about the group's call for Biden to free federal prisoners held on marijuana charges.
Sadly, as of today, President Biden has given freedom to more turkeys than he has to people. This is a gross injustice and an injustice that President Biden could correct with the stroke of a pen. A pen just like this could give hundreds of people their freedom and write history.
And we'll speak to the Israeli journalist and former conscientious objector Haggai Mattar about Gaza and Israel's crackdown on the press. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's renewed its attacks on southern Lebanon, killing at least 12 people and threatening to further unravel Israel's truce with Hezbollah. With the latest attacks, the UN says Israel's committed more than 100 ceasefire violations since agreeing to halt attacks last week. In response, Hezbollah said it had fired rockets at northern Israel as a retaliatory measure. Earlier today, Israel's defense minister, Israel Katz, warned his military would no longer distinguish between Hezbollah and the Lebanese state if the ceasefire collapses. Israel's continued its unrelenting assault on Gaza with attacks on the northern town of Beit Lahia today that killed at least 8 people while leaving 20 others wounded. In Gaza City, dozens of civilians are feared trapped under the rubble of a 4-story building leveled by an Israeli airstrike. On Monday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called the situation in Gaza appalling and apocalyptic and said Israel may be guilty of the gravest international crimes. The UN reports Israel's killed at least 341 humanitarian workers since it began its massive assault on Gaza nearly 14 months ago. Meanwhile, Gaza now has the highest number of child amputees in the world per capita, with many children forced to endure surgery without anesthesia due to Israel's blockade. And the World Health Organization reports more than 10,000 cancer patients remain stranded in Gaza, awaiting permission from Israeli authorities to seek care abroad. This is Dr. Mohammed Abu Afsh, director of the Palestinian Medical Relief Society.
Tragically, even with the necessary authorizations, they cannot leave. The Rafah crossing is closed. The Erez crossing is closed. The Kerem Shalom crossing is closed. Every exit point around Gaza is shut down. How can these patients leave? They are enduring unimaginable suffering. A mechanism and solution must be devised to allow them to exit Palestine for treatment.
Hamas said Monday 33 people held captive in Gaza had been killed by Israeli strikes since October of last year, while other hostages had gone missing. Among those said to have been killed was Omer Nutra, a 21-year-old Israeli-American tank commander detained by Hamas after its fighters raided an Israeli army outpost. Hamas also released a video showing Israeli-American Eidan Alexander, a soldier taken captive by Hamas on October 7th, calling on President-elect Trump to negotiate a ceasefire and prisoner exchange. Hamas's announcements drew a threat of renewed violence from Trump, who wrote on his social media site, quote, "There will be all hell to pay in the Middle East. Those responsible will be hit harder than anybody has been hit in the long and storied history of the United States of America, unquote. On Sunday, Trump hosted Sarah Netanyahu, the wife of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and their son Yair at Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces have arrested at least 18 Palestinians over the past 24 hours. On Sunday, the youngest Palestinian ever to be imprisoned by Israel began a one-year prison sentence. 14-year-old Ayam al-Salaima was convicted of throwing stones at Israeli settlers last year when he was just 12 years old. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem reports the boy was subjected to violence and humiliating treatment during an interrogation. Meanwhile, B'Tselem has uncovered repeated cases of severe abuse of Palestinians by Israeli soldiers in Hebron. Victims describe being randomly seized by soldiers as they went about their daily affairs. They were then beaten and subjected to severe abuse, sometimes in full view of the public, and at other times inside military outposts. The Biden administration said Monday it's sending Ukraine another $725 million in weapons from its stockpiles, including missiles, drones, and anti-personnel landmines, amidst fears the incoming Trump administration could cut off military support to Kyiv. The announcement came as German Chancellor Olaf Scholz traveled to Kyiv to meet with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, where Scholz vowed to supply some $680 million in new military aid. Scholz also had this warning for Russia's president.
Das sage ich heute hier in Kiew ganz deutlich an die Adresse Putins.
My very clear message from Kyiv to Putin. We are in this for the long haul, and we will stand by Ukraine for as long as it takes.
Over the weekend, President Zelensky indicated for the first time a ceasefire that includes temporarily giving up land that Russia has seized could be an option if NATO agrees to protect Ukrainian-controlled territories. Earlier today, NATO chief Mark Rutte said Vladimir Putin has no interest in ending Russia's war in Ukraine and will continue, quote, using Ukraine as a testing ground for experimental missiles, unquote. On Capitol Hill, President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet picks for his new administration have been meeting with senators ahead of Trump's inauguration and confirmation hearings. During a meeting with Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville, Pete Hegseth, Trump's pick for Secretary of Defense, was peppered with reporters' questions about the latest revelations published by The New Yorker magazine, including that Hegseth was forced out of leadership roles at two veterans organizations for misusing funds, sexually harassing women, and being repeatedly drunk on the job.
You misspent funds, mistreated women, were intoxicated on the job. Do you have any comment about that reporting at all? Any comment about that reporting?
Well, I have to say that.
So that article suggests you have an alcohol problem.
After their meeting, Senator Tuberville praised Pete Hegseth. Tuberville is a staunch Trump ally who's publicly supported white nationalists and made racist comments. A Delaware judge has reaffirmed her decision to void a $56 billion compensation package for Tesla CEO Elon Musk. On Monday, Judge Kathleen McCormick upheld her January ruling, which noted the astronomical 2018 pay package was the largest ever for a publicly traded corporation. Elon Musk is already the richest person in the world, with a net worth estimated at more than a third of $1 trillion. Meanwhile, Musk has promised to delete the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau when he takes the reins of the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, under President Trump next year. His pledge comes after the CFPB finalized a rule to supervise tech companies which offer digital funds transfers and payment wallet apps. Those are features Musk is working to add to his social media site, X. At The Hague, Netherlands, a landmark climate case is underway at the International Court of Justice. Over 2 weeks of hearings, the court will consider what countries around the world are legally required to do to combat the climate disaster. The case was brought by low-lying island nations which face an existential crisis caused by wealthier polluting nations. This is Ralph Regenvanu, special envoy on climate change for Vanuatu, which is leading a coalition of more than 100 countries and organizations in the historic case.
Coming to the International Court of Justice, we are trying to find another way to get climate action that we need, that the IPCC says we need, that science says we need, but which so many countries, through political convenience and the power of fossil fuel lobby, refuse to take action on.
Australia has passed legislation banning social media use for children under 16 years old. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese touted the first-of-its-kind law as he spoke from Canberra on Friday.
World-leading action to make sure social media companies meet their social responsibility. Social media is doing harm to our children. Platforms now have a social responsibility to ensure the safety of our kids is a priority for them.
Platforms like TikTok, Facebook, Snapchat, Reddit, X, and Instagram could be fined up to $33 million U.S. dollars if they systematically fail to prevent users younger than 16 from having accounts. It's unclear if the ban will affect ties between the U.S. and Australia. Elon Musk, a close Trump ally, blasted the ban as a backdoor way for the Australian government to control internet access. In response, Albanese said of Musk, quote, he has an agenda. In Germany, tens of thousands of auto workers at nine Volkswagen plants have gone on strike after VW demanded 10% wage cuts and threatened to close German factories for the first time in its 87-year history. Members of IG Metall union staged two-hour work stoppages and threatened to begin an open-ended strike unless VW managers drop their demands for plant closures. This is Daniela Hildebrandt, one of about 14,000 striking workers at VW's Hanover plant.
We are totally ready to go on strike. The mood is obviously subdued since they show absolutely no goodwill. We are all scared. Many of those who are nearing retirement are really scared that they could lose their job now. I am a mother of two children. I commute over an hour every day to come to work here. I love my job. I don't want to lose it.
Volkswagen is the largest private employer in Germany. And a judge in Wisconsin has struck down parts of Act 10, restoring collective bargaining powers for public workers. On Monday, Dane County Circuit Court Judge Jacob Frost ruled the law signed by Republican Governor Scott Walker in 2011 violated the Wisconsin Constitution's Equal Protection Clause since it exempted police and firefighter unions from a ban on public sector workers' right to negotiate labor contracts with the state. Act 10 drew massive protests in 2011 when it was proposed, including a rally of over 100,000 workers and a weeks-long occupation of the Capitol building in Madison. You can see our coverage of the Wisconsin uprising at democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, President Biden is in Angola today, becoming the first sitting U.S. president to visit the African country. The trip is also Biden's first to a sub-Saharan nation as president. Biden is there in part to promote a multi-billion-dollar rail project that the U.S. hopes will counter Beijing's influence in the region. The project would connect the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Zambia to Angola's port of Lobito, allowing the U.S. to exploit the region's vast mineral resources, including copper and cobalt. The ongoing plundering of resources from the DRC by the U.S. and Europe has led to decades of devastating war, poverty, and environmental destruction. President Biden's visiting Angola as the country prepares to mark the 50th anniversary of its 1975 independence from Portugal. Biden's meeting today with Angola's president. He's also scheduled to give a speech at the country's National Slavery Museum. We're joined now by two guests. Antonio Tomas is an Angolan scholar and associate professor of anthropology at the University of California, Irvine. He's the author of In the Skin of the City, Spatial Transformation in Luanda, and is completing a new book about the civil war in Angola. And Zenaida Machado is the Angola and Mozambique senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Antonio Tomas, let's begin with you. Can you talk about the significance of President Biden first sitting U.S. president to visit Angola, and tell us about Angola's history?
Amy, thank you so much and for having me. It's a historical trip to Angola. It's a historical visit, particularly in the context of relationships between Angola and U.S. As we know, Angola and U.S. haven't been properly friends or foes in the sense that Angola took the side of communist pro-Soviet during the Cold War, right? So, and then the U.S. were supporting the regimes that tried to uproot the MPLA from power, right? On first on the side of the Portuguese during colonialism, and then on the side of FNLA, and then UNITA, and so on. The U.S. only recognized Angola's independence in 1991, 16 years after Angola became independent in 1975. And it, of course, it has been an effort of, you know, it's a victory of Angolan diplomacy, and because a lot of people have put money and resources and time to get these trip, to get these visits in happening, but it has also, it comes also with a lot of problems.
And you mentioned the civil war that occurred, all the great powers that got involved. Also, Cuba supplied up to 50,000 soldiers to support the MPLA in that war. What was the outcome after the MPLA was able to be victorious in terms of the social conditions of the people of Angola?
It has to be said that the U.S. has always been on the losing side in all the major interventions in Angola, right? They were with the Portuguese lost. They were with FNLA, FNLA lost. They were with Savimbi's UNITA, and Savimbi UNITA lost, right? And now they with the MPLA, and I believe that MPLA lost the next election as well. So the U.S. has always been on the losing side when it comes to Angola. And of course, the, you know, it was a major confrontation of, you know, of two mighty powers during the Cold War. On the one side, the Angola government, the forces of Angolan government backed by Soviet Union and Cuban troops and so on. And the other side, apartheid South Africa, backed by CIA and supporting UNITA, Savimbi, and so on, and it was tragic for the country, you know, because we're still facing a lot of problems. We're still solving problems of, you know, of the consequences and how the Cold War has played out in Angola, you know, with millions of people dead, millions of people displaced. We still have a lot of, you know, landmines that still have to be extracted from the soil. And the country is still grappling with all these consequences of the Cold War.
And the United States did not recognize Angola's independence until Bill Clinton was president?
Yes, the United States didn't recognize Angola's independence until 1991, when Bill Clinton was president. So Angola actually didn't have normal diplomatic relationships with U.S. until that date. And even when Clinton recognized Angola's independence, it took a long time, you know, from 91 to now, because then, you know, Angola organized, elections after the end of the first Cold War in 91. So the Cold War ended in 91, Angola organized elections in 92, but then Savimbi didn't accept the results of the elections. The country went back to war for more than 10 years until Savimbi was killed in 2002. And then, of course, the diplomatic relationships between Angola and U.S. start to be normalized.
I wanted to bring Zunaida Machado into this conversation, who's in Mozambique, in the capital Maputo, senior researcher at the Africa Division on Mozambique and Angola of Human Rights Watch, previously worked with BBC. If you can talk about the significance, I mean, of this first ever trip of a sitting U.S. president to Angola and what it means that it is tied to the strengthening of business links and what these links are. Why is President Biden there, Zinaida?
Thank you so much for having me. I was listening to the previous guest, and there's one thing that sticked to my mind, the legacy of the Cold War. And one of the legacies of the Cold War in Angola is the habit of propaganda. I mean, doing things for the world to see. And I think this visit by Biden to Angola is a bit of that. It's a visit that tackles the exterior, not the internal problems of Angola. It's focused only on business, on a project that will mostly benefit those that will import from the minerals in Central Africa, but less of Angolans, the majority of Angolans. And if you are in Angola today, you probably also feel the same way, that a lot of these visits has excluded the majority of Angolans. They have been given two public holidays today and yesterday and today. They cannot come even close to where the Biden convoy will pass to. And those, for example, that wanted to use this opportunity to freely protest and show the American authorities how much they are grieved by the policies that have been adopted by subsequent governments of Angola, were not allowed to do so. So that's the Angola we are talking about. So if you ask what is the significance of this visit to a majority of Angolans, they'll probably say, well, it's a big show. It puts Angola on the map. Angola becomes an important country for the world. João Lourenço, of course, is a big achievement diplomatic for him. But what about the large part of Angolans that are still living under one USD per day?
And Zinaida Machado, I wanted to ask you about the former president and the Eduardo de los Santos, and then of his daughter Isabela dos Santos, who and the corruption that developed during and especially toward the end of the President dos Santos's 38 years in office. Could you talk to our listeners and viewers about his daughter, Isabela dos Santos, and where she is right now?
I'm not sure where she is at the moment. I know that there is an investigation and a criminal case against her for corruption and embezzlement in Angola, and that the Angolan authorities have requested the international community to help find her and bring her back to Luanda to respond for the crimes that she's accused of. For those who follow Angola, they will know that during the time that her father was president, and that was about four decades, she benefited a lot from the state coffers. She became one of the richest women in the world, and probably or arguably the richest woman in Africa, but she has also had the privilege to run the state oil company. And Angola is highly dependent on oil. Oil is the biggest export of the country and the biggest source of revenue. And the daughter of the president was the one in charge of that state company. There were lots of questions about how she qualified, different from other Angolans, to run a state company. She has claimed over the years that she is as qualified as any other Angolan because she's an Angolan citizen. But questions remain as to why would the president appoint his own daughter to run the state money. But it's not just her. Her own brother also ran the country's sovereign fund for several years, and he was towards the end of his mandate accused of misusing billions of money that was put in that institution that should have gone to the Angolans to improve the lives of Angolans, and instead were used for the benefit of the family, the Santos family.
So I want to ask Professor Tomash about why President Biden is there at this moment. I mean, to promote the multi-billion dollar Libido Corridor, that 835-mile railway project connecting the city of Lobito in Angola to the Democratic Republic of Congo and Zambia as well, this show of U.S. investment is meant to counter China's increasing influence in Africa, the sort of alternative to China's Belt and Road Initiative. Can you talk about that, China's presence in Africa, and where the U.S. stands in relation to that?
We know why Biden is in Angola. You know, we are in a moment of transition from fossil energies to greener energies. And then we know, you know, that in the next few decades, some minerals will be preponderant, very important for, you know, for the economy, for the global economy, right? Minerals such as cobalt, lithium, and copper. Right. And we know that some of the sources of these minerals, some of the largest sources for the extraction of these minerals are in close to Angola, right, in the Congo and in RDC and Zambia. And this is an opportunity. It's a way to sort of revitalize, you know, the Benguela Railway that was built by, you know, by the Portuguese with British and South African interests in the 1900s. So to revitalize this railway, you know, and to be able to ship the minerals from these sources, you know, to the coast, to Lobito, to the port of Lobito, right? But we also know that Angola provides something that U.S., you know, is looking for, you know, in terms of creating partnerships in Africa, because Angola is one of the most stable political regimes in Africa. You know, we have the same ruling party since 1975. We only had three presidents, one of them stay in power for almost 40 years, you know. So to have a, you know, an infrastructure that runs for more than, you know, 1,000 kilometers, it will require a great deal of security and safety. And U.S., of course, sure, or at least they want to be sure that the Angolans can provide that.
And Antonio Tomas, I wanted to ask you, much has been made of the debt that the $40 billion in debt that Angola owes to China. I should remark that that's about half of the debt that Puerto Rico owed to the United States bondholders, tiny Puerto Rico. But how is China regarded by the Angolan people? Because it's been involved in economic development projects in Africa now for decades.
Oh, yeah, this is a, of course, you know, I think it's important to see, you know, when China started to become involved in Angola. That was, you know, after the war, when the boom, the oil boom was also taking place, you know. So Angola had at this moment, you know, a great deal of financial resources and so on. So China got involved and China, you know, loaned all this money to Angola, you know. And I think now that the country is going through, you know, a profound economic crisis, Angola has been struggling to pay these debts. You know, a lot of this money was used for the reconstruction of the infrastructure that were destroyed by the war, point dams, bridges, and so on. But a lot of this money also was used to enrich, you know, for some people to enrich themselves, and particularly to transfer, you know, these amounts of money and to buy property, you know, elsewhere in South Africa or Portugal, in Europe or in US, you know. So a lot of this money have been used or has been canalized, you know, has been used for personal purposes, you know. And now Angolans are paying, actually, you know, the debt that the that the country owes to China. And of course, China is still involved in a great deal of projects in Angola, in a great deal of construction and rebuilding. And I think this is the place that U.S. wants to occupy.
I wanted to end by going to Zenaida. Human Rights Watch has written about how the projects connect with crackdowns on protests in Angola, projects that exacerbate poverty and other conditions for people in Angola, only enriching a few. And you're speaking to us from Mozambique. I'm wondering if you can also talk about the ongoing nationwide protests there following the elections in October, when the long-ruling Frelimo party declared victory.